Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. There's no doubting the profound influence the George Kaiser Family Foundation has had on the city of Tulsa. Facilities like EduCare are giving many families a badly needed leg up in some of our more distressed neighborhoods. Women in Recovery is offering a helping hand to women who would otherwise be incarcerated, turning them into taxpayers, not tax users. And of course, you need only see a snapshot of the Brady District some 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, to see the profound changes this thriving community has had with Guthrie Green, the Woody Guthrie Archives, the other parts of the old Matthew Automotive Complex that have been restored and redeveloped, and that has, of course, spurred all sorts of private development as well. Now, after renovating that and the River Park's trails, the foundation is trying to forge that same kind of community on a larger scale with the Gathering Place on Riverside Drive next to River Park's. Today we learn what drives the foundation's investments and learn about the projects they're funding and what they're learning in the process of creating equal opportunities for every child in Tulsa. My guest today is Ken Levitt, the executive director of the George Kaiser Family Foundation. Prior to joining the foundation, he was president of OU Tulsa. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. In the area of full disclosure, we should mention that the Family Foundation does fund our licensee, the University of Tulsa, as well as Public Radio Tulsa itself. Ken Levitt is our guest today. Ken Levitt, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm a big fan of the show, so it's great to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. And, of course, a lot of people in this community are fans of the George Kaiser Family Foundation, and everybody thinks they know it because you're involved in a lot of different projects. But because you're involved in a whole lot of different projects, most of us only know a part of what the Family Foundation is involved with. What is the overriding ethos of the foundation?
I'd say a couple things. I mean, number one, the overriding ethos and the ultimate ambition or aspiration of the foundation is to try to give young children the same great shot at equal opportunity that most of us received. And George has a saying that he often puts forth, which is no child really bears the responsibility for the circumstances of his or her birth. So if you're born in a low-income environment, really wasn't your fault, or if you're born in a family that wasn't a great nurturing family, it's not like it's the child's fault. So what's our collective responsibility and role in helping everybody achieve everything they can be to realize their full potential, the potential of our community and our country? I think that folks in Tulsa know us a lot in some degree because we're so focused in Tulsa, and it's unusual for a foundation with this level of resource and reach to be as focused in one community as we are. But that's actually probably what is most exciting about the foundation, in the sense that we're pursuing these objectives in a pretty tightly bounded environment. And it's been a great journey these last half dozen years.
And what is the reasoning behind that? Because a lot of times when you have a broad overreaching goal like that, a foundation would be reaching out across the country saying, let's find the very best practice, and if it's halfway across the country, we'll pilot that and then maybe bring it back to our own community, or hopefully it will spread beyond that community. But really, this foundation is really based on, okay, let's figure out what the best practice is, and let's try it out. Let's experiment here in our hometown.
Yeah, we certainly are looking across the United States and elsewhere for great ideas, but the concept is always to see what could be imported back to our home community to try to fit a need here. And I guess there might be a time someplace in the future where we'll have conquered every problem in Tulsa and everybody will be climbing that ladder of success in such a way that we don't need to keep investing in Tulsa. But these problems are pretty intractable. So there's quite a bit to do, I think, in our community. You know, and I think there's a healthy debate that goes on within our foundation about whether or not we should be in other geographies, but we tend to come back to Tulsa as a place where the need is great. And there's something that I think helps us be more effective by being geographically bound. I mean, yes, there's quite a great need to be all throughout the world. But then again, it's quite difficult to measure your success that way. It's hard to know about problems like corruption and waste and inefficiencies. And by working in the community in which we live, we feel like it makes our dollar go further as far as effectiveness and evaluation and just being on top of things.
Now, in addition to funding projects towards that goal of equal opportunity for young people, you also have what started out as maybe just side projects has grown quite large in the last few years of this sort of civic engagement of cultural and civic projects. How did that get started at the foundation?
Well, I think we're always telling ourselves and trying to live up to the mission, which is our core mission of making investments and working towards equal opportunity for all kids in our community, especially young children, and the earlier the investment, the better. But you're right. We do have a handful of projects that are outside that immediate scope, the park along Riverside or the trails at the river or Guthrie Green in the Brady area. And I think we get to those in a few different ways. Well, one of which is, we live in this community, the family that created the foundation, George Kaiser and his family came here from Nazi Germany. His dad was a judge in Germany and was disbarred when the Nazis came to power, and Tulsa gave them shelter to an immigrant family. And there's a sense of paying an obligation back. I'm sure that's a part of it. The other conversation that we have, maybe it's to justify it, or maybe it's to try to argue that it's consistent with our mission, is simply to say, look, rising the economic prospects of the whole community, lifting the overall economic boat and the quality of life boat for Tulsa, redounds to everyone's benefit wherever you are on the income scale. So if we can recruit talent to come to Tulsa, if we can reinforce our business's effort to retain their talent and to expand in Tulsa, all of that's good for everybody. So that's helped encourage us for these projects. So the Brady area, north of downtown, is an arts and cultural destination. That's just something that strong cities have, and we kind of lacked it. So we decided that was something we want to build towards, and it's been one of our more successful projects because so many others have also joined in it, and it's been great. The trails on the Arkansas River have really taken off, and that helped encourage us to work on this park idea. We do try to always, even when we're doing civic projects, we try to do projects that we think will be for everyone in the community, not gated areas of privilege, but places where everybody, east, west, north, south, will come and enjoy it and feel very welcome.
Looking over the plans for the gathering place, there's a lot of enrichment opportunities for people of all classes and all parts of the community. I think the idea is it really is a gathering place where that equal opportunity ethos sort of comes out, even when it might be in recreation. But what I see from the various projects is it's going to be a great learning environment, too.
I certainly think you're right and hope you're right. We're so ensconced in the construction phase of all this right now, and it's a four-year project just to build the park. And by the way, also from the help of many others in the community and the foundation's support, it may end up being the largest privately supported public improvement maybe in U.S. history. It's looking like a $300 to $400 million project. And it's a massive undertaking and something that we're all very excited about. I can't wait to get to the time where we're really working on programming and designing all the learning opportunities, the summer educational experiences, the music and culture opportunities, but obviously play and learning. And the folks who we're working with, who are the architects and designing the playground area, they're some of the world's best as far as how to engage kids of all ages in very active learning at the park. So it's going to be, we really have the greatest hopes for it.
I want to talk a little bit about the Guthrie Green and the investments in the Woody Guthrie Archives and the foundation's part, also the geothermal
right.
project for that area as well. But you also had city investment in that area. It seems like it's come together pretty well. Is that a good model for how a city, any city, works with private investment to really create something bigger than either one could do by themselves?
I think it really has proven itself to be an exciting model and accomplished a lot of what we have hoped. We believe strongly in public-private partnerships. We feel that it works for both sides of that equation. Much of what we do as a private foundation on some level performs public duty, so of education, infrastructure, cultural infrastructure support, et cetera. So to a great degree, we're doing things that other communities might have their public sector do. So it's natural for us to seek a partnership with the public sector. On the other hand, I think there's a very important benefit that the public sector gets by partnering with philanthropic partners, and that is largely an oversight function that is achieved. Because when a foundation or a private business person is spending its own funds, his or her own funds, it's watched pretty darn closely. And I think the public sector also watches its funds. I'm not saying that it doesn't. But there's a level of skin in the game that's achieved by having another partner that is highly cost conscious, highly results oriented, And I really see that as, they might say, a virtuous circle. It's just a good kind of partnership.
Can you give us an example of how that worked in that particular project where the city oversight was helpful to the overall end result?
Yeah, I mean, at Guthrie Green and in the Brady District writ large, there are just multiple levels of mutual support. So the foundation bought the land and improved the land and above. And actually, that case helped also below with these geothermal well field, which is about, I think, 300 wells, each 100 foot deep, and it's one of the larger geothermal well fields in the United States.
How is that working out in actual practice in a real Oklahoma winter?
You know, that's a good question, and there are probably people who are more on the ground who might be able to give a more precise description, and I'm sure there have been challenges, but largely it seems to be working. It's supplying the power effectively to the park itself and also to the Matthews Building that's just to the south of it, where TU has space and the Philbrook has space and Woody Guthrie Center and Contemporary 108 all have space. And I don't know. I was there yesterday and I was toasty there. So I think it's working, and we're getting some economies out of it because it's actually a highly efficient form of power. So, but look, George Kaiser Family Foundation is not going to rip up the streets to put the wiring under the streets or to change out the traffic light that's necessary. So you've got to have the city or the county in certain circumstances as your partner to do these things. And, you know, what's another great thing about working in Tulsa, those relationships are strong, and we get from here to there in pretty quick order. In fact, on that project, and we hope also for the Gathering Place, the city put together kind of a red team to expedite any problems that we had so we could all save funds and achieve the results as quickly as possible. And that kind of spirit has been really important then and now for the Gathering Place.
In its first couple of years now, has it succeeded beyond your vision of what you were expecting? Has it happened? Things happened faster than you expected.
Yeah, and I think
I think that's the interesting thing to me is I think it's happened a lot faster than a lot of people anticipated.
Yeah, and we have our share of things that are slow and frustrating and unsuccessful. So I don't want to talk about only successes, but I think Guthrie Green and the explosion of energy in the Brady Arts area is among the most successful things we've been a part of. And again, I think it's nice if people want to give us the credit for doing it. It's probably not right because there were numerous people who were doing some small-scale things for decades there. Think of David Sharp and the guy who has a coffee shop and, you know, dozens of others. Then the ballpark came. That was crucial. And perking along all that was we had done some land banking there and some planning, and it just kind of all came together, and I feel like it was something that Tulsans really craved. And Guthrie Green on a beautiful weekend day is like a totally exhilarating experience when the music's going and people dancing on the green and events and food everywhere around. It's perfect.
Do you think you can duplicate it or even multiply that effect with the Gathering Space?
I sure hope so. It will be different. You know,
because it will be a little more nature, really. I mean, because you're talking about a pretty big space with a lot of open space.
Yeah, the scale is, you know, much larger for the Gathering Place, and thus it will be less intensive. You know, Guthrie Green on a heavily programmed day is a ton going on in actually a pretty small amount of space, basically one city block. The Gathering Place, I think, will be more pastoral, but it also, one thing, the key feature of the Gathering Place from a landscape architecture standpoint is the fact of these land bridges that connect one side of Riverside, the east side, where the bulk of the park will be, via these two land bridges to the trail system. And so I think that the greatest long-term benefit of the Gathering Place will be that it really is a linkage to Turkey Mountain to the south, or the River Park's trail system, which can get you to Festival Park, or, you know, the restaurants over the pedestrian bridge over at 29th and the restaurant at 19th, the volleyball fields at 71st. And then you've got this enormous park with a lodge and a boathouse and a restaurant and an incredible play area right there between 26th and 33rd.
Do you think that will spur development on the West Bank? You know, because there's this redevelopment site that's been offered a couple of times and nobody's really come up with the right project for that. Do you think that's going to spur that development?
I think we're definitely going to see adjacencies get developed, whether it's the west side or whether it's on the east side of the Riverside
or low water dams.
Or low water dams or more restaurants in Brookside. I think we'll see a lot happen. It's kind of fun to see some of the real estate agents advertising the homes for sale by saying next to the future side of the gathering place. And so I think that's a great signal. I love when I hear about that.
My guest today is Ken Levitt, the executive director of the George Kaiser Family Foundation. We're talking about the impact of the George Kaiser Family Foundation. We've kind of spent a lot of time on the cultural, but let's spend some time on the social services. And earlier you said, you know, this has been one of the biggest successes at the Guthrie Green. You said some have not been so successful. What's been you opened the door, so I'm going to walk through it.
Well, I don't want to pick on anybody, but you know, it's.
But what's been more intractable, or maybe a more difficult project than you first thought going in?
Well, you know, politics is always hard. Anytime you're trying to change opinions or affect the legislature or the public opinion, you know, we had a fairly tough experience in 2007 when we first tried to be strong advocates for a river investment package. And actually, the voters in the city of Tulsa were quite in favor of it. But we didn't tell everybody in the suburbs, and just we weren't able to get it done. And that slowed us down on the project. But, you know, we picked up our backpacks and kept working on it. And that, I think we got a better plan now with the gathering place, frankly. So ultimately, it was okay that what happened. You know, here I am at the University of Tulsa, so I shouldn't pick on higher education. But I think that higher education is sometimes a hard partner, because it's just big, and there's a lot of institutional dynamics there. So it's the kind of institution where you really got to pick your partners carefully and have a really clear set of objectives. And actually, the programs that we are now working with in higher education, with TU, OU, OSU Medical School at the hospital, the OU School of Community Medicine, TU on a lot of fronts, are actually quite excellent, but it can be slow going, and
when you're collaborating between institutions, it becomes even more difficult.
Exactly, and you know, you've got public partners, et cetera. So it things take a while, and we're impatient.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the social service projects. Yep. Two that have been fairly high profile have been the Educare Centers. Mm-hmm. Those have been in operation for a few years. Kendall Whittier the first, and now there's several around the city.
Yes.
How are those working out? Are we learning things about what they do well, what they maybe don't do as well as we hoped, or doing things better than we expected?
Yeah. I think the results are largely quite strong on the Educare front and the early childhood front. We're learning some interesting things, though, one of which is that it's very clear that dosage matters. So the longer the child has the benefit of this very high-quality experience called Educare, the better the results are. So if a child is just there at age 3 and then on to the elementary school next door, well, there's some benefit. But by far the most pronounced benefit as far as kindergarten readiness will occur if a child's been there as many as 3 years, so came at little under 1 and stayed there all the way through 3. We're getting results that we are really quite satisfied with. We also have about 3 other major studies that are underway that will teach us quite a bit about what's working and what's not. Now, it also is the case that it's expensive. So we estimate that at Educare, we're spending mid-20,000s per child per year. So that's a quite an expensive undertaking, and it's probably not something that you can extend to every child who needs it. But we sure want to at least deploy the best aspects of it to as many kids as we can. So we're looking for options and alternatives to isolate that which has the most effect and which we can proliferate a little bit more broadly and thus have a little less expense and more reach. So communication strategies to parents, for instance, about reading to your children, addressing something called what we call the word gap, for instance, mm-hmm. which I can talk about a little bit if you
That's basically you just the kids don't know as many words as kids in an environment where you're read to. And
it's I mean, it actually is quite remarkable, some of these studies that show across 4 years a child from an upper-class family might hear as many as 30 million more words than a child from a low-income family. So it's rather extraordinary when you extrapolate it across 4 years. So getting more literacy-rich environment and communicating to parents and grandparents and caregivers, because not everyone's going to be in an Educare, but how could you reach them through cell phones and bodegas and billboards and messages on diapers about some simple messages about reading and narrating your day and talking to your kids? That sounds kind of corny. On the other hand, a lot of public information campaigns over the course of 10, 20 years have had some pretty powerful effects, whether it's smoking or designated driving, et cetera. So we're going to be looking at some ideas like that. It'll be less expensive than the ultimate Educare experience, but hopefully with some impact.
You also mentioned to me the health component of Educare is maybe a nurse visitation program.
Yeah, one of the most studied and most effective interventions for new parents and young children is to have a nurse visitor to the family, maybe before the baby's even born, to the mom, and then over the course of, say, once a month for the next 2 years, to just kind of check in, be a resource, talk about best practices as far as health and nutrition and reading. And that's a less expensive effort than Educare, and there's actually an increased amount of research and resources which is supporting that kind of project. And it's known around the country as in its most prominent model, nurse family partnerships, and in Oklahoma it's called Children's First. And so we're looking at some ideas about how to make that program a little more efficient but also reach more kids.
Another area which gets a lot of publicity is the Women in Recovery program, which is a divergent program for women who have been incarcerated, skills, life skills, job skills,
yes,
training, and then I guess some follow-up over the course of their graduation from the program to make sure that they don't go back to prison for any reason. How's that working out? I hear it's not 100%, but it's better than intervention is helping.
It's better than prison. We definitely know mm-hmm. that and significantly from a results and cost standpoint. Every year we have a kind of a summit or a retreat among our funder, George Kaiser, some of his friends and advisors and people who work in business with him, and then our board and some people from the community. We really try to identify what are some of the most vexing and frustrating problems that confront our community, and then also, is it a problem that we could do something about? Half of them we say, I don't think we can do this one. We want those power lines buried. Well, we can't fix that one too easily. We'll have to call somebody else. But the issue of incarceration of women in our community being twice the national average and all the kids that affected, that drove us to work on that project. And I think we are seeing some terrific results there, and certainly at a much reduced cost than what the state pays to incarcerate the women.
Is it scalable, do you think?
Yeah, I think this program is enormously scalable to meet the need in Oklahoma, at least. And it's actually quite simple. We spend practically $500 million a year incarcerating people, about 23,000 men and 3,000 women, roughly. Well, especially with regard to the women, where 60% of the women are incarcerated for nonviolent offenses. Those funds, the $16,000 or $18,000 a year that the state pays for each of those women, so over seven, if it's 7 years, that's practically $150,000. We can spend $20,000 of those funds and have a much better result by working on drug therapy, trauma therapy, parenting, coaching, et cetera. Now, they need to be supervised, needs to have enormous amount of rigor, et cetera. But what's not scalable is what we're currently doing. What's scalable is what we could do with a program like Women in Recovery.
And of course, when you talk about the direct costs, that's one cost. But think of if a woman has children, they go into the foster care system. If they're going into the state system,
yeah,
that's another whole set of costs that we're not even trying to figure in.
Absolutely. And it's a very emotional experience to go to these graduations after the roughly a year of work and therapy and diversion services. They graduate from the program, and every one of them has a job at the end. Some of them might be at a hotel, others might be at a manufacturing facility, but they'll raise their arms and say, "I'm a taxpayer." they're paying sales tax, they're paying income tax, and they're not only not a drain to the public resource, but they're contributing to it, and they're happy about it.
Yeah.
They're proud of it.
Can you give us some idea of the success rate? Because it's been going a while. I mean, is it closer to 100 than it is to without
sure.
these services?
I think that the recidivism rate at large for women who are not in the program is in the 30-50% range. So roughly third to a half return to prison if they've been in prison. So these women who are not in prison but in a much cheaper and more effective diversion program have a recidivism rate at about half of the level that they would have had they actually gone to prison. So you're at a kind of about a 15% rate thus far. And we're working with state government right now on a program we call a pay-for-success model. There's a lot of different variations of this. But we want to go to state government and say, look, we'll invest X amount of dollars. We're at 100 women now. We'll go to 200 women. But here's the deal. If we're going to spend $15,000 per woman, and you would have spent $150,000 per woman in the correction system, then if we're successful, if the woman stays out of prison for 3 years, pay the program back the $15,000 of investment that was made into it. You saved $150,000. Pay back the $15,000, and then that'll allow us to take the program to the next 100, the next 150. And so, you know, you've got to have government think differently is not simple, but we're really working on that, and other states are doing it. So we think there's possibilities there.
Earlier you mentioned about the summit that you have each year. I think most people would be interested to know how does the Family Foundation make their funding decisions? What's the process? Yeah.
Well, we're unusual, not unique, but unusual in that we don't really accept applications for funding. Now, we get a lot of great communications from people with good ideas, and it helps us in our thought process, but we're not a traditional foundation in that we put our interests out on the web and then we seek applications and then we have rounds and interviews. That's not kind of what we do. We really try to highlight in an annual conversation and then followed up by some quarterly meetings, what are the problems that we would like to address that inhibit success for kids and inhibit kids from reaching their full potential and kind of the American social compact, and what will work the best. So that's how we really came upon early child education. The science is so strong that the return on that investment is the best that there is. That's how we developed the interest in the problem of over-incarceration of especially women for nonviolent offenses. And so we have that conversation, and we try to figure out, well, is there a strategy that could work? And if there is, that's kind of how we pick our top 10. We have a top 10 list like David Letterman.
And from those strategies, you find some strategies, and then you approach other nonprofits about, hey, we think this might make a difference.
Exactly. You know, we also do a lot of scouring around the country. For instance, EduCare was not something we created here. It had its roots in Chicago, and then the Buffett family had really invested in it to expand to Omaha. So we do a lot of investigation into models that have worked, and some are homegrown, emerged from local thought leaders. You know, Stephen Dow at CAP, and Mimi Taraj and Gail Lapidus are some of the. These are some of the best nonprofit thinkers in America. But other programs, a program called CEO, which is about people coming back from prison and getting jobs, temporary jobs, followed up with job placement services for permanent jobs, or a program called Youth Villages, which is a really exciting way to turn around the traditional foster home model. So we'll go out and we'll look for best ideas. Usually other foundations help us do that, and then we see whether they're in the mood to expand to Tulsa. We'll ask other people in Tulsa to work with us to do it, so we can have partners in the funding. And we've probably brought a dozen kind of programs in that with that style of exploration and import and getting a partner. TPS, Tulsa Public Schools Union Public Schools, have worked closely with us. Once you have a program, you need a partner to actually do it, and that's been essential.
Well, we wish you great success with the work, because we can see the difference it's making in the community nearly every day. Ken Levitt, thanks very much for joining us.
Appreciate it very much.
Ken Levitt is the executive director of the George Kaiser Family Foundation. If you'd like to learn more about the foundation's activity, visit their website at gkff.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.